The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Breck, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. Thank you, Carter Glass. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Well, this is the June 1st, 2021 issue. Our date for Our State, celebrating North Carolina. Normally, I would be breaking open the cover of a brand new issue, but the USPS has not delivered it yet as of the date I am recording this. So we're going to take one more week of the May 2021 issue. Not a big deal, because there happened to be five Tuesdays in June, so we're not going to miss our usual four and occasionally five issue sequence over there. So things will be okay. And there's always more to read in Our State than we ever get to, so let's dive in and see what you weren't going to be hearing. Heroes of Healing. Sherry Beasley in Pembroke, Native Healing. Growing up in the close-knit Lumbee community, an educator in Robeson County walked the same farmland as her ancestors. Today, she gives back to that land by nurturing nursing students from across rural North Carolina. Written by Vanessa Infanzon. Each time Sherry Beasley walks into the Weinstein Health Sciences building at the University of North Carolina at Pembroke, she steps across a tiled image of a turtle, a sacred Lumbee symbol. Its round shell is a Native American medicine wheel split into four colors, black, red, yellow, and white, that represent the stages of life as well as the emotional, mental, physical, and spiritual parts of a person. The design is intentional. Each element embraces central parts of Lumbee culture. It reminds me of my call to practice, Beasley says, my call to be a nurse, to care for people, to be holistic. Beasley is one of 55,000 members of the Lumbee Nation, the largest native tribe in the state, and the largest tribe east of the Mississippi. Lumbee values have informed Beasley's life profoundly, from her childhood growing up on a farm in Robeson County to her current jobs as the Ann R. Belk Endowed Professor for Rural and Minority Health at UNCP and chair of the school's Department of Nursing. I look at the sacrifices that my parents and grandparents made to provide for others, Beasley says. Our whole drive in life was to take care of the people living on the land that we were meant to protect. I see my work as a continuation of that. Beasley grew up in a tight-knit community on her grandparents' tobacco and cotton farm in the rural heart of North Carolina's Lumbee County, or country, rather. She lived with her parents and two siblings in a four-room shotgun house with painted board sidings and beadboard walls. Aunts, uncles, grandparents, great-grandparents, and cousins were always around and central to Beasley's life. Even now, more than half a century later, walking barefoot on freshly plowed dirt still reminds the 69-year-old educator of her days pulling nutgrass from the field before it killed the crops. I learned a strong work ethic and the value of family and the value of relationships because that was the world that I lived in, she says. Beasley saw firsthand the importance of public health to the Lumbee and other rural communities. She was drawn to the health care field as a teen, watching nurses care for her grandmother, who had been diagnosed with cancer. The nurses developed a special bond with their patient. They stuck with her from the time of her diagnosis to her death, Beasley remembers. It had a phenomenal impact on my decision about my profession. After high school, Beasley pursued her BSN at the University of Michigan and later earned her master's in nursing and public health nursing from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a postmaster as a family nurse practitioner from the University of South Carolina, and a PhD from the East Carolina University. She was the first Lumbee to obtain all of those degrees. Beasley returned to Pembroke in 1985 to help the people in her community that raised her. "I knew I could make a difference for the Lumbee, but also for the rural population at large," she says. "I'm committed to them equally." In 1992, UNCP Chancellor Joseph Oxendine launched a nursing education consortium between the Pembroke School and the Fayetteville State University. At a family gathering, Oxendine, Beasley's cousin, asked if she'd put in for the first faculty member position. He reminded her of the family call to community service. Beasley promptly applied and was accepted. In the years since, she's become a role model for nursing students throughout North Carolina and beyond. Brooke Grooms, a nurse practitioner with UNC Southeastern Health, is one of those students. Her own Lumbee connection to Beasley provided great comfort while she was studying. Beasley, Grooms says, was the support system for all of us. She always pushed you to do better. Today, more than 200 students are enrolled in UNCP's pre-licensure RN/BSN and master's degree programs. When Beasley reflects on the impact that she's had on Lumbee and rural communities, she recalls a nugget of wisdom from her great-grandmother as it relates to the land. She said, "You can have pine trees. They are strong and they reach into the soil, but there's also a need for beauty." Beasley recalls, "I want to create something here that not only provides for people's basic needs, but that also aesthetically enhances who they are, their whole well-being. Combining beauty with wellness, it's a long-standing Native tradition." Again, Heroes of Healing, this page, North Carolina Pioneers, the Outer Banks nurse, Kathleen Bragg, who lived from 1897 to 1975. In 1958, when a flu epidemic sickened 60% of Ocracoke's 500 residents, nurse Kathleen Bragg treated them by telephone and messenger. She was the only trained healthcare professional on the Outer Banks Island, and she was sick with the flu, too. "I went just as long as I could," she said in an interview at the time. "Then I started contacting people by phone and sent their medicine by messengers. Finally, she called on the state for help, and a doctor arrived by boat." Bragg was born and raised and died in her family home near the island's iconic lighthouse. In the early 1920s, she left for 3 years of nursing school in Rocky Mount. Back on the island, she not only treated the sick and injured, but she also delivered more than 100 babies. She traversed the island on foot, regardless of the weather, juggling various duties, including school nurse, home health nurse, and hospice nurse. When tourists discovered Ocracoke after World War II, the official town map included the location of her home so visitors would know where to go for that medical help. "Nurse," the notation read. And now, another Heroes of Healing article. Patricia Horoho, that's H-O-R-O-H-O. I'm going to pronounce it Horoho. Fayetteville. Called to serve. Growing up near Fort Bragg instilled in one young nurse a sense of duty to community and country. She'd go on to reach the rank of lieutenant general, eventually assuming command as Army Surgeon General, the first woman ever to do so. Written by Jennifer Brookland. Despite the fact that Patty Horoho took her first breath on an army base, and that her dad was part of the greatest generation and a three-time war veteran, and despite her upbringing in Fayetteville, one of the most military-friendly cities in the country, she laughs when you ask her whether joining the armed forces was a foregone conclusion. "It wasn't at all," she says with a chuckle. "Think about it. When I was in high school, women did a couple of things. They were secretaries, teachers, or nurses. They were not typically soldiers. When Horoho graduated from E.E. Smith High School in 1978, it had only been 11 years since the law capping women at 2% of the enlisted forces had been lifted. So Horoho considered the slim trio of professional opportunities presented to her. Initially, she'd wanted to be an airline stewardess, but she was too short. She liked the idea of teaching and of nursing, and her mother and grandfather urged her into the latter, a profession that they said would allow her to make a positive difference in the lives of those who were most vulnerable. Her coursework at Appalachian State and then the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill taught Horoho the era's style of bedside nursing. But it dawned on her one day as she sat in the back of a nutrition class her senior year that she wanted to do something different, something a little unexpected, just for a little while anyway. She met the Army recruiter on Franklin Street right across from Spanky's and didn't tell her family anything until after she'd applied. Trust me, everybody was a little shocked, but totally supportive, Horoho says, and I never regretted it. It was one of the best decisions that I've ever made. The career move that Horoho thought would be a 3-year diversion was the first step on the path to becoming Army's most successful nurse in its centuries-old history. Lost my place for a moment, sorry. In 2011, she assumed command as the Army's Surgeon General, the first woman and the first nurse ever to hold the position. But Horoho's commitment to a military career didn't start with awards and accolades. It started in a broom closet. After a first duty assignment threw Horoho into her leadership as the head of emergency room nurse at Fort Carson, Colorado, she found herself unexpectedly transferred to be a nurse recruiter in Pennsylvania. They were some of the Army's lowest performing recruiting brigades, and the nurses in charge of them had walked out on the job or had been fired. No one expected much. I'm going to show them, Horoho thought as she sidestepped into the office chair that had been crammed into the closet for her. We're going to be successful. A month or two later, she went to the battalion commander and told him she'd commissioned a nurse to join on active duty. Well, you're 100% better than your predecessor, he said. She commissioned no one. Dismissed. A few months later, Horoho's broom closet was empty. Her desk chair had a new home in the second largest office in battalion headquarters, and Horoho had a new appreciation for the career that the Army might offer her. She could be both a nurse and a soldier, a manager and a leader. As the 23rd Chief of the U.S. Army Nurse Corps, Horoho oversaw more than 9,000 nurses in active duty and the reserves. As the 43rd Army Surgeon General and Commander of the United States Army Medical Command, she led the third largest health care system in the world, overseeing billions of dollars and more than 156,000 people across 5 continents. But her leadership style has always been grounded in the lessons of her hometown and her family. The military mothers and wives who stepped in with quiet strength to share in the good times and the sad ones. The grandfather who immigrated to find work in the coal mines that always reminded her to play team ball. As she thinks of them, Horoho is reminded to see and value everyone who contributes to mission success. Like the housekeeper she spoke to while touring a hospital in Germany. What do you do? Horoho asked her, and the woman proudly replied, I keep people well. Never mind that her job was to sweep and mop, not save lives. Her work was critical. She was part of the team. Horoho has been building strong, successful teams since her time as a nurse recruiter. And from those early assignments, every experience of her snowballing career seemed uncannily as if it were divinely delivered to equip her for the next. Like the frustrating master's degree research that forced her to become an expert on critical incident stress debriefings, trauma care, and comparative burn dressings. When she was reassigned to be the head ER nurse back at Fort Bragg in 1944, 1894. Her studies led her to insist on intense planning for a mass casualty event, even planning a simulation that would test the hospital's response to a mid-air plane crash with multiple trauma victims. Weeks before the simulation was to commence, Araujo got an urgent call from the emergency room. Planes had crashed on the adjacent airfield. Casualties were coming in. "Oh, is this our exercise?" Araujo asked. "No," came the answer. "This is real." The Green Ramp disaster, as it became to be known, was the most grievous loss of life suffered by the 82nd Airborne Division since World War II. An F-16 fighter jet collided with a C-130 cargo plane, and although the pilots ejected, the speeding disintegrated F-16 struck another grounded cargo plane and punctured its fuel tank. The resulting fireball, laced with wreckage and exploding ammunition, breathed death down a corridor where 500 paratroopers were awaiting training flights. Araujo sprang into action as 134 burn victims arrived at Womack Army Medical Center by truck, sidecar, and anything else that moved. Their uniforms burned off, their airways too damaged to breathe. It was horrifying and tragic. And yet Araujo also saw in people's heroic and selfless acts the best of human nature. Araujo always thinks of Sergeant Daniel Price, a soldier who threw himself on top of another as the fire washed over them, then whispered in her ear to crawl out from under him and run for safety. She was able to escape and survive. He sacrificed his life for hers. That's the American spirit, Araujo says. That is, to me, the essence of Fort Bragg. Just as Araujo's research made her uniquely prepared for mass casualty events in Fayetteville, her deployment to post-earthquake Haiti, where she saw what a prolonged response to a public health crisis required, allowed her to spring into action on September 11th at her next duty station, the Pentagon. "If I had not had that experience, I wouldn't have known what to ask for in the midst of the chaos," Araujo says. Looking back, Araujo strongly believes that God put her in those places at those times. Those experiences enabled her to be a better leader and a more impactful servant. "The higher you go, what I've learned is, the more humility you should have," Araujo says, "the more your lens should be outward." A couple of sidebars here. North Carolina Pioneers, the organizer, Mary Louis Wyche, W-Y-C-H-E, 1858 to 1936. Mary Louis Wyche wrote a book on the history of nursing in North Carolina and also played a starring role. After graduating from Philadelphia General Hospital Training School in 1894, she took a position as chief nursing officer at the new Rex Hospital in Raleigh, where she opened the state's first school of nursing. The hospital of only 23 beds was rather small to have a school of nursing, she noted, but there were patients who needed care and young women who wanted to be taught the art of nursing. The classroom was located near patients so students could answer call bells when needed. Inspired by professional meetings in other states, Wyche decided to form a nursing association in North Carolina. But no one showed up for the organizational meeting. Undeterred, she alerted nurses again about an important meeting of the Raleigh Nurses Association. Curiosities piqued, they all attended. Within a year, the Raleigh Nurses Association broadened to become the North Carolina Nurses Association. As association president, Wyche lobbied the legislature to enact nursing laws. In 1903, North Carolina became the first state to pass a Nurse Licensure Act. Second sidebar, North Carolina pioneers the first black registered nurse in the United States, Charlotte Roan, 1874 to 1965. Charlotte Roan was barred from studying nursing in North Carolina and from working at the hospital in her hometown of New Bern. But Jim Crow laws couldn't prevent Roan from achieving her dream. Along the way, she became a beloved and respected community leader. Roan earned her degree from Freedman's Hospital, a school of nursing in Washington, D.C. in 1901, and earned her living in New Bern as a private nurse, providing home health care and helped deliver babies. She's thought to have been the first African-American registered nurse in the United States and was a charter member of the National Association of Colored Graduate Nurses. In 1922, when the Great Fire of New Bern burned 40 blocks, Roan tended wounded African-American residents at a makeshift hospital at a church. White hospitals refused to admit them. Roan was one of the thousands who lost their homes and had to live in tents. Instead of building a new house, Roan and her sisters built a hotel where they lived upstairs. The Roan Hotel was included in the Green Book, a resource for black people traveling through segregated America. Roan also opened a shirt and dress factory to provide local jobs and helped in the founding of a hospital and library for black residents. Her outreach did not go unnoticed. Craven County hired Roan as its first black social worker. She rose to become the first African-American assistant superintendent of the Craven County Welfare Department. Last of the sidebars, the loving leader, Margaret Dolan, 1914 to 1973. When Margaret Dolan spoke to the first graduating class at East Carolina College's nursing school in 1964, she offered a one-word prescription for excellence in nursing: love. St. John of the Cross said at the end of life that we will be judged by love, Dolan said, not by achievements and successes, but by love. Not by what we did so much as with how much love we did it. Dolan led by example. Her achievements were many, among them chair of the Department of Public Health Nursing at UNC Chapel Hill, first North Carolinian to serve as president of the American Nurses Association, and the only person to serve as president of three national nursing organizations, the American Nurses Association, the National Health Council, and the American Public Health Association. She also served on advisory committees under Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson. She accomplished it all with grace and compassion and with love. Alas, too often we hear nurses refer to the appendectomy in room 214 or the burns in room 561. Dolan said at an ECC, we must know patients better than this. We must know them as a mother with four small children at home with no one to care for them, or a young high school girl with leukemia who has read enough magazines to know the ultimate outcome of her illness, or the active, prosperous businessman who has suddenly been faced with the paralysis of a stroke. Well, that ends our section on Heroes of the Healing. And at this point, we are going to go back to some small articles in the front of the magazine, and we'll just see how far we get in the next 5 minutes. Welcome home. Drink up. Hendersonville, cider a la Blue Ridge. Surrounded by rolling acres of blossoming European apple trees, a cidery in rural Henderson County brings a taste of northern France to North Carolina. Appalachian Ridge Artisan Hard Cidery's warm, inviting tasting room transports customers to a different time and place, say a rustic tavern in pastoral Normandy, France. Inside the 1940s European-style barn, original rough-hewn wood extends from floor to ceiling, and the stall doors now crown metal tables. And by the way, there's a picture of that here. And it's exactly what it is. Picture a wooden floored building with some wooden tables and some chairs in the center. And starting at the floor, you've got some beams, open beams, coming up at an angle and then angling again and then angling a third time until they come to the peak of the room. And then they angle back three times to come back. And then there's a crossbar up high to get extra support, and you can see the inside of the what looks like a metal roof above the slats that are laid on this framework. And you see the inside of, well, I guess it might be shingles or something on the front door, on the front wall next to a double door. So it is a beautiful all-wood room. The only new fixtures are the lighting and a distressed copper top bar. The three-year-old cidery sits on 100 acres of owner Alan Ward's centuries-old family land. Appalachian Ridge produces five Normandy-style ciders that range from dry to semi-sweet. Crisp and effervescent, the beverages are the product of a complex melding of French and other European apple varieties with names like Benet Rouge and Belle de Boscoupe. The orchard grows 42 apple varieties used to make the ciders, 14 of which aren't grown anywhere else in the country. Ward has been operating St. Paul Mountain Vineyards nearby since 2008. His foray into cider isn't a leap, though, because, as he explains, cider is a wine in that it's fermented fruit juice. And the bottled ciders, which are named for nearby mountains, deliver a complexity that's on a par with fine wine. Appalachian Ridge Artisan Hard Cidery is on Chestnut Gap Road in Hendersonville. They have a website, stpaulfarms.com. And now, welcome home portrait, Dobson, the log whisperer. A Surrey County native has made a name for himself building, rebuilding, and restoring log cabins using reclaimed wood and old-fashioned methods. A client gave Kevin Thomas the nickname Log Whisperer. And it's true. Thomas has been whispering to logs since 1980, building and rebuilding hundreds of homes with reclaimed wood. The Dobson native says that usually there's some sentimentality involved for people who yearn for a cabin on their century farm or a small yard ornament to retreat from the world. There's hardly a house in Bethania, the state's first planned Moravian settlement in Forsyth County, that Thomas hasn't worked on. Soon he'll restore a cabin built by Thomas Jefferson in the Shenandoah Valley. I do it the old-fashioned way, Thomas says, beginning with a dry-stacked stone foundation. While disassembling, he numbers each log for reconstruction. Mortar comes last. As a custom woodworker, Thomas has created twig-style railings, shoe molding fashioned from tobacco sticks and cedar posts with the roots still attached so that the post seems to be growing from the floor. As long as it ain't brick or vinyl, I'm agreeable, says Thomas, who feeds off of other people's passion. I want to build something that looks like it's always been there, a place people hate to leave and want to come back to. Here's a picture of this older gentleman with a brown hat on, with a brimmed hat. It looks like he's been around a while. He's wearing a vest, and he has I was going to say a scraggly beard, but I don't know that it's scraggly. It's a little far away, and it comes down to a point in his chest, but it's a kind of a light brown or almost reddish brown color. There's a picture of one of his cabins here. It looks really nice. You can see the metal roof on it, and you can see it's all old wood, but new mortar between it, the pieces of the wood on the front, and the mortar stripes are about two-thirds the widths of the logs themselves. It says Kevin Thomas's most recent project is restoring and expanding this 19th century cabin in Yadkinville. It's rare to find logs preserved as well as these, he says. And now welcome home shopkeep, Winston-Salem, the shop around the corner. A former neighborhood pharmacy is now, you know something? I see that I accidentally pushed the volume down on the music here, so I didn't hear it coming up. And we're almost out of time. Good thing I caught that, or all of a sudden it would have all disappeared. That's it for this episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it. Listen next time. Any comments, questions, call the studios, 919-781-1973. See you next week.